Tonight we're going to look at Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 to 45, a very, fairly short piece, but with a lot there. Before we begin, I'll do what I've done the last couple of weeks to just get the meeting going, but wait for a few folks if they want to come in who aren't here yet. Any questions on anything we've covered so far in the book of Daniel that we could take a few minutes on if you have one at this time? I found it interesting that back when I started preaching what I'll preach tonight, or teaching what I'll teach tonight on Daniel 11, I picked up some ideas from a couple of my teachers at college and another professor that I listened to some tapes of after I'd been out for several years. And something hit me and I began to teach something. And I was the only one on the block that I knew of who was taking this specific angle. And I bounced it off a few people and I got some interesting looks. That's a possibility. I haven't really reviewed the Adventist literature or other literature on the subject over the last several years. And Hetty gave me a book the other day to review on the subject. And Hetty, I reviewed it. Basically saying exactly what I say, at least the unique part of the conclusion that I had been drawing, he draws. And that's good. I've never desired to be unique as much as I don't really care if anybody else is saying the same thing I'm saying. But it is nice when two people who didn't get their heads together come up with the same conclusions. At least there's some sense that maybe you're not completely off in a wild goose chase. What's that? Let's see, what was the book? Russell Burrell? Was that it? New World Order, Russell Burrell. What he did with the King of the North and the South was similar. I don't know if that book's still available or not. Yours is falling apart. It's a cheap book. That's right. Good insides, cheap outsides. Okay, let's have a prayer and begin. Father, we are grateful tonight for your word. Teach us things from it that can be of value to us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Tonight we're looking at Daniel 11, verses 40 and 45. We will see, I believe, introduction letter A, that Daniel 11, 40 through chapter 12, verse 3 deals with the modern era, the era in which we live, present and future, and shows us the climax of human history and the final coming of the kingdom of God. I'll just put it this way. I believe these verses we're going over tonight are the microcosm of which Revelation is the macrocosm. Do you understand those two words? Micro is tiny, macro is big. These five verses, or six verses, are what the bulk of Revelation expands on. Letter B. When one deals with prophetic predictions that have not yet taken place, one explains them, one then assumes the mantle of prophet. That mantle I do not claim to possess. So what I say concerning the future is tentative and food for your thought and consideration. Most of what we have talked about so far in the book of Daniel has already come to pass. There are a couple little pieces like the judgment of Daniel 7 that have not yet come to pass. But those were broad contextual concepts or broad concepts about what God is doing. Tonight, when we look at some prophecies that seem to be very specific about what's going to happen on this world, in this world, yet future, I always hold those. I may believe them and argue them to the last word, but I still hold them tentative because most of the time when you discover how people have tried to predict the future using prophecy, they've been wrong. Okay? You'll notice that I will not draw specific conclusions. I will draw conceptual conclusions, and I always hold myself to that, or I try to, when it comes to things that have not yet happened. Letter C. The purpose of prophecy, a very important point. I don't have this text on the screen, so turn to the Gospel of John, chapter 14, verse 29. John 14, verse 29. And if you're using the Bible in the seat back, the softcover New King James, those numbers do not match. The numbers did not get updated on your notes. They only work with my Bible, so they're not of much value to you tonight. Chapter 14, verse 29, Jesus says, "Now I have told you before it comes to pass, that when it does come to pass, you may believe." Jesus predicted some things here to his disciples, and he says, "Look, I've told these things to you so that when you see them, your faith will be strengthened." He did not say, "I have told you things so that you can now predict the future." That's why I think God does future prophecy in symbols. You flat can't go ahead of time on them. They only take meaning, specific meaning, as the things come to pass. And they build our faith in God and our trust that he knows what he's talking about. But they do not allow us to become prognosticators of the future. We can see the shape of things to come. Like Jesus said, we can know the season, but we can't know the day or the hour. The same principle, I believe, applies to symbolic prophecy. We can see the season of what's ahead, but we can't see the day and hour. We can see the overview, the conceptual movements and interplay of events and possible powers, but we cannot come down to the minutia and the actual historic and literal, because we're not there yet. Prophecy is so that from our current standpoint, we can look back and say, "Wow, God has always known what he's talking about." That's clear from specific historical fulfillment. We can look forward and we can see the shape of things to come. We can understand how to prepare for those kinds of issues. And we can trust that God will see us through. But we're not going to get the actual understanding of the fulfillment until things roll from the future back into the present as we move forward. You follow that? Okay, that's introduction. Daniel chapter 11 now, verses 40 to 45. At the time of the end, that's important, we'll come back to that. At the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him, and the king of the north will come back against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, with many ships. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. The shape here seems to be is that at the time of the end, that seems to be a specific point in time, the king of the south, whoever that is, will attack the king of the north, and the king of the north will fight back against the south with everything he has, overwhelm and pass through. In other words, the north will get attacked by the south, lose some of its power, but the north will attack back against the south and regain all that it's lost. He will also enter the glorious land. It has something to do with God's people. Many countries will be overthrown, but these will escape his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He will stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. That appears to be the south will fall to the north again. So the north attacks the south attacks the north, the north counterattacks with everything he has and eventually takes over. So then verse 43, would be the north, shall have power over the treasures of the gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, the south. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his hand. But news from the east and the north, that's something new coming in, will trouble him, the king of the north. Therefore he, the king of the north, will go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he, the king of the north, will plant his tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he, the king of the north, will come to his end and no one will help him. That's what we're going to cover tonight. Of course, that was clear, wasn't it? We don't need to explain that, do we? Okay, let's look at it. Time frame. Roman numeral number 2, letter A. The time frame at the time of the end. If you go to Daniel chapter 2, where you have the great image with the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the iron, and the feet of iron and clay, and the stone cut out without hands, where in that image portrayal would be the time of the end? The feet and the stone. Those two coming together, that would be the time of the end. Go to Daniel 7. You have the papal power, or the little horn that we identified as the medieval papal power, reigning for 3.5 times, after which comes the judgment, and then the kingdom goes to Christ and the saints. So when would the time of the end be in that passage? It would have to be that judgment coming of the kingdom event that wraps things up. Go to chapter 8, number 3. We find that the 2300 days, leaf back there with me if you would in your Bibles, in verse 14, unto 2300 days in the sanctuary will be cleansed. That's the time prophecy. Verse 17, he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on his face, and he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to when? Time of the end. Verse 19, look, I am making you known what will happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time, the end, literally. So what is the end of time, the time of the end in the vision of chapter 8? It would be the end of this 2300 cycle of verse 14, which, well, we'll just leave it there for a minute. Chapter 9 asks the question, what about this 2300? We explained all that when we looked at it, number 4. 70 weeks are cut off, and we noted they go from 457 BC on down to the time of the coming of Christ, and if you add on the 2300 to work with that whole thing as we charted it out, that takes you down to 1844. That has something to do with the time of the end. Daniel 11, verses 31 to 39, we did parallel columns in our last get-together, and we noted that those verses parallel the work of the little horn during the 3.5 times, after which appears to come the judgment and the time of the end. So this is looking at the latter part of all of the prophecies. If you line them all up, there's pretty much a general time where each one is terminating right around the coming in of the kingdom of God. When is the time of the end? Turn to chapter 12. This is important. Verse 4. We're jumping ahead a moment here to try and figure out when the time of the end is. But you, Daniel, this is, by the way, the epilogue now of the book. The explanations are over. We have the epilogue. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book. It must be referring to the book he's just written, the things that he's just written down. Shut up the words and seal the book until when? The time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. That seems to suggest that many will run to and fro in the pages of the book during the time of the end, and knowledge of what's in the book will increase once it's opened up again in the time of the end. But shut it up now and seal it until that time, the time of the end. Verse 5, I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this river bank and one on that river bank. So there are heavenly beings standing on each side. Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, a third heavenly being, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things will be finished. Catch the sequence of that verse. There is a proclamation that says, after the 3.5 times comes the time of the finishing of all things. Verse 8, although I heard, I did not understand, and I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? He said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed and sealed till the time of the end. Now, my personal belief is that when you take those verses and look at it carefully, it tells us that the time of the end is the time after the book of Daniel is opened again. It's sealed until the time of the end. When's that? The angel raises his hands to heaven and said, it's 3.5 times, then we're going to finish things up. Lord, help me understand. Look, it's sealed until the time of the end. I believe, according to these verses, that what it tells us is that the time of the end is the period of time beginning with the end of the 3.5 times up until the coming of the Lord. Okay? Now, there is a huge difference in the Bible between the time of the end and the end of time. Do you know what those are? The time of the end is the time while God's wrapping things up, and at the end of the time of the end comes the end of time, when Jesus comes again and brings things to an absolute end. You know, I've heard of people who lived on the farm and they had a turkey, and it's about October and they're fattening the turkey up. That's the time of the end. See, and on Thanksgiving Day, that's the end of time. So that's how the two come together. We have Christmas time and we have Christmas Day. Same idea. So it appears that there's a point in time or a period of time down at the end of time At the end of the time prophecies that seems to begin after the 3.5 times when the book is sealed, then it will be opened again, and that's called the time of the end. I believe personally that from 1798 on is known as the time of the end, and when Jesus comes again, that'll be the end of time. The book of Revelation tells us all about what happens during the time of the end. Daniel 11, 40 to 46 tells us all about what will happen during the time of the end. Let's catch up with the notes here. When is the time of the end? We've looked at number one. The book is sealed till then. How long? Till the 3.5 times are over. That's the time of the end. So the time of the end, number two, is the time when the book will be unsealed again and all things will be finished, and it comes to the close of the 3.5 times. Number three, we already noted in study number nine that 3.5 times goes from 538 to 1798, the 1260-year period, a papal supremacy during the Middle Ages. So 1798, number four, I believe, marks the beginning of the time of the end, when the book of Daniel will be unsealed. When we study Revelation 10, we will find this 3.5 time prophecy applied specifically to another angel who raises his hands to heaven, just like in Daniel 12, and instead of swearing it'll be for 3.5 times, he says, time's up. So Revelation 10 will show us how at the end of the 3.5 times, the little book is open and what happens. We'll have to wait till we get there to study that. So 1798, I believe, marks the beginning of the time of the end when the book of Daniel is unsealed again, after which the little horn is judged and executed and the kingdom is given to Christ and he gives it to the saints. And it ends when the stone kingdom comes and destroys all the kingdoms of the world, fills the earth, and reigns forever. That's the end of time. So the time of the end is an era of final things and judgment lasting from 1798 to the second coming of Christ. That's how I put it together. Okay? That's the framework we're going to work from tonight. Therefore, chapter 11, verse 40, when it says, at the time of the end, it doesn't say during the time of the end. I believe it's pointing to something that's going to happen right at the close of the 1260 years, at right around 1798. When the time of the end begins, something is going to happen. What's going to happen? The South is going to attack the North. So far, so good. Turn the page. Who is the North and who is the South? Well, letter A, let's look at some general principles. First of all, we learned last time that the North and the South are enemies of each other. You'll recall the king of the North was the Seleucid power during the time of the Greek era, after Alexander the Great and before Rome, the intertestament period. And the king of the South was the Ptolemaic portion of the Greek Empire. And Israel was the glorious land caught in the middle. And these two powers hated each other and hated God's people. And God's people were constantly getting run over while they were trying to get at each other. So, the North and the South are enemies of each other. Number two, the North and the South are both enemies of God's people, the Jews, who inhabit the glorious land and are geographically caught between the opposing forces. Number three, some important points. After the closing of the 70 weeks of Daniel 9, the 490-year probation for the Jews, which ended in AD 34, we charted all that out when we studied Daniel 9, literal Israel, I believe, is succeeded by spiritual Israel, the true children of Abraham by faith, or the church, which becomes God's chosen agent to spread the gospel to the world. Catch these verses. In John 8, Jesus is talking to the Jews who believed in him, and he said, if you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. They answered him and said, we are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free? Now notice that phrase, we are Abraham's what? Descendants. Do you recall opening night, I talked to you about how Abraham was what nationality? He was Semitic, and he was from where? Ur the Chaldeans. He was a Chaldean. The Chaldeans are Semitic. And Abraham was a Babylonian Chaldean who listened to God and obeyed. What made Abraham different from his other Chaldean neighbors? Faith and obedience. And because of his faith, he obeyed and he moved out, and God made him a great nation. And we talked opening night about how he established that nation as a missionary light to the world. God never had a favorite bloodline. He wants to save everybody. He loves everyone equally. He had a faith line. Institution called Israel, which was to be a light on a hill to shine the gospel to the world. We noted, first of all, they went and became like the world, so he sent them to Babylon, sent them back to Babylon. That was our opening night topic. If you're going to act like the Babylonians, you just as well go home. You're cousins. After the Babylonian captivity was over, the Jews that returned to Palestine said, boy, we're not going to apostatize anymore. In fact, we're going to build such a high wall around us, we can never go wrong. The only problem is they put a bushel over the light. So first they apostatized and lost their value. Then they became provincial and lost their value. Until by the time of Christ, they thought God only loved Jews and everyone else was fodder or fuel for hell. And it took the church, we noted, several years of God doing miraculous deeds to finally catch on that God wants to save everybody. So we noted that the uniqueness of Israel is not bloodline, it's faith line. A non-Israelite could become an Israelite by faith, and an Israelite without faith was cut off. It's an issue of faith, not bloodline. Jesus says to the Jews, we who said we are Abraham's descendants, notice how he comes back, we'll look at that in a minute. We are Abraham's descendants, the Jews said. The word descendants is the Greek word sperma. Do we need to explain that? That's pretty clear, isn't it? We're talking physical offspring by the natural processes of human progeny. So that's clear. They said, we are Abraham's sperma. We are his physical offspring. Jesus said, I know you are Abraham's sperma. Did he deny that? No, Jesus confirms, yes, you have literally descended from Abraham, physically, bloodline. But you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. You don't have any faith. I speak what I've seen from my father. You do what you've seen from their father. They caught on immediately that he was suggesting Abraham might be their physical father, but he wasn't really their father. And they came back with a retort, well, yeah, who's your dad? Which they were constantly throwing in his face, the idea that he was illegitimate. They answered and said to him, Abraham is our father. And Jesus said, if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. Now notice, Jesus said, I know you're Abraham's descendants, but what does he say here? You're not his children. Now wait a minute, how does that work? You are of your father the devil, he says a few verses later. Note the wording, descendants is sperma, that's clear. Children is techna. Children means dependence as opposed to descendants. Do you know the difference between a dependent and a descendant? You are descendants of your parents, but on their tax returns, most of you are no longer dependents. Right? God has never cared who you descended from. He cares who you're depending on. And Jesus makes it very clear that you can be a descendant and have of Abraham and have your father be the devil because you're acting like him and you're depending on him. It's always only mattered to God who you're depending on, not who you're descended from. We're all descended from Abraham, and he was made by God, and God promised salvation to Abraham and all of his descendants who would have faith. I mean to Adam and all of his descendants. We're all children of Adam. So, I bring this one up simply to show that Jesus very clearly makes a difference between a descendant and a dependent. And he's always only cared about that. Israel was a physical institution that God put together to keep truth alive. Think about it this way, and I'm going to shoot from the hip here, so if I'm wrong, forgive me. Adam lived, I believe, over 100 years intersecting the life of Methuselah. Adam lived 900 and some years, and Methuselah lived 969 years. We always said he was the longest man who ever lived when I was a kid. Adam overlapped Methuselah by over 100 years. Methuselah lived until the flood. In fact, his name means when he dies, it will come. He was a living prophecy that when he died, something major was going to happen. He dies the year the flood came. When the year the flood came, Shem was 100 years old. Methuselah overlapped Shem by 100 years. Shem lived until Abraham was 150. Do you follow that? You can go 2,000 years into history all the way to Abraham, and you've only had to pass the truth about God on from Adam to Methuselah to Shem to Abraham. During Abraham's lifetime, everybody born before him of the patriarchs died. One of them outlived him by about 11 years. Lifespan shortened in such a way that all the succeeding generations die in the same generation, the time of Abraham. And from then on, you have rapid generational succession with short lives. What's going to happen to truth? Have you ever played gossip going around the circle? The more transitions, the more distortion. So when God loses the long life, long transition, he says, I've got to institutionalize this thing. I've got to get it written down. I've got to create a people that will hold it close. I've got to do something. And the Bible begins to be written through it, through Moses. This people come out. He puts everything together. So now there's an institution to give some continuity to things here. That's why Israel is called. And of course, when that institution falls apart, what they were supposed to do is look forward to the cross by faith. I'm suggesting that who then is Israel after the cross? It's those who continue the faith line, not those who continue the bloodline, who fell away from faith. Do you follow that? Now look at these. In other words, it's dependents, not descendants. Look at these verses. Romans 2:28. For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, physical, external, nor is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one what? Inwardly, and circumcision is out of the heart, in the spirit, not the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. Paul says real Judaism, real Israelitism, is an inner thing, not an external thing. It's a dependency thing, not a descendancy thing. It's a faith thing, not a blood thing. Have you got that? Paul says this in Galatians 3, therefore know that only those who are of what? Faith, and he's talking about faith in Jesus Christ, are the sons of Abraham. Dependence, as opposed to descendants. For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus, for as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ, and if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Notice Paul argues eloquently that the line is a line of faith. It doesn't matter who was your daddy. What it matters is who is your spiritual father. And those who looked forward by faith to the cross were Israel. And those who look back by faith at the cross are Israel. Israel is a faith line. Therefore, I believe the church, meaning those who accepted Jesus, whether they were Jew or Gentile, continues on, as Paul says, as the true Israel of the New Testament. So when you get past the end of the 70 weeks, the end of the 490 years, the end of the time of Christ, when you look at the concept of Jew in Bible prophecy, you've got to go to spiritual Israel and see it as referring to the church. That is a principle that I will apply and that I believe, and I've argued as best I could right now. That was number three. Concluding, thus after AD 34, references to Israel and the glorious land take on, note these words, an extended spiritual global dimension, transcending the local geographical applications. Israel becomes God's faithful people wherever they are found in the world. In the same way, to be consistent, now follow this logic, the oppressive powers of the north and the south can no longer be bound by the geographical locations, nationalities, and kingdoms, but must represent powers spiritually like the ancient geographic kingdoms who become oppressors of God's people and enemies of each other on a global scale in the time of the end. Do you follow that? Now let's apply it. And I think it'll become clear. Who is the king of the north? Well, according to Jeremiah, the first power that came from the north and dominated and devastated God's people was Babylon. All through the book of Jeremiah, Babylon says trouble's coming from the north. Look out, the soldiers from the north are going to come and wipe out the land. Who overthrew Babylon? Oh, by the way, before we get to that, number two, What does Babylon represent? It comes from the Tower of Babel, which represents let's build a tower and save ourselves, religious apostasy, do-it-yourself religion. Babylon claims to be following God, but doing it on its own terms. It is apostate truth, if that makes any sense. It's the truth gone bad, while claiming to still be the truth. So the north here, Babylon, is apostate religion. Who took over from the north, or from Babylon? Medo-Persia. So Medo-Persia becomes the next power to the north that is over God's people. Who took over from Medo-Persia? Greece, and specifically the power of Seleucia, reigned in that same physical area. Who took over from Seleucia? Rome became the power from the north. And we trace that down through chapter 11, verses 1 to 39. Now, Rome takes us past, in its physical history, that pivotal point of the end of Christ's time on earth, when physical Israel, literal Israel, becomes spiritual Israel. And I would like to suggest, therefore, we pass from a literal king of the north, Rome, kingdom, to something of a more spiritual nature. And what? Whoops. Let's back up one here. I think we'll get it right again. What power came out of Rome that became an oppressive power to God's people for a long, long time? 10 horns came out of the beast, and then came the little 11th horn that plucked up 3 and did all the terrible things. The papacy, the medieval papacy, Rome papal, takes over from Rome pagan. But notice, we're no longer dealing with a pinpointed political power. We're dealing with a global spiritual issue as well. Just as the church, global spiritual, takes over from physical Israel, so the apostate church takes over from that power, which is the legacy of the original apostate Babylon, king of the north. You follow that? I think I just took care of number 6, but let's look at it. With the rise of the papacy, letter A, the issues and language of prophecy transcend local, nationalistic, and geographical dominion to encompass an extended spiritual dominion on a global scale. And I've given you lots of verses you can look up. Thus, we no longer seek to identify the king of the north by geographical location and domination over the Jews. Instead, we must look for a power which matches in each detail the physical and spiritual description of the prophecy and has dominion over the church. The context, sequence, and description of Daniel 11:31-39 reveal that the medieval papacy is the king of the north, whom therefore the south must attack in verse 40. Therefore, I believe the king of the north equals apostate religion allied with political power, as exemplified by the little horn, which equaled the medieval papacy up until 1798, the 3.5 times of Daniel 7. Are you with me so far? Okay? Once you get into the Middle Ages time, once you get past the time of Christ, Israel physical, literal, becomes Israel spiritual, the church. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, literal, king of the north, becomes spiritual, global, little horn, medieval papacy, king of the north, dominating the church now rather than physical Israel. What about the south? Who's the king of the south? Well, Egypt was the original power of the south that oppressed God's people and enslaved them with harsh bondage, and God let them out of Egypt by his great mighty outstretched arm at the Exodus. Egypt next shows up very clearly in chapter 11, verses about 5 to 15, as the Ptolemaic kingdom of the south, and there it's called the king of the south, the Greek Ptolemaic kingdom. Now, when Rome came on the scene, the king of the south, Egypt, was brought into the king of the north. It became part of the Roman power. And the south disappears for a while. Then in verses 25 to 30, the south reappeared in the I don't know section. Remember that last week? I still don't know. The king of the south reappears again at the time of the end, attacking the north in verse 40. At the time of the end, 1798, the north, the medieval power of the Little Horn, will be attacked by the south. Page 3. What would be the extended spiritual identity of the king of the south? All we can do now is go back and look at what the archetype of Egypt is. The Pharaoh of Egypt is personified as one who said what? Who is your God? Never heard of him. The north said, oh yeah, we worship the same God, we just do it our way. Egypt said, never heard of the guy. The north is apostasy, the south is denial, is what I'm suggesting. The religion of ancient Egypt involved the deification of nature and natural science. Egypt is a symbol of what is opposed to all religions. We'll see that in Revelation 11:8 when we study that next fall. I believe the south pinpoints atheistic denial of God in contrast with the north, which is the type of corruption and apostasy. The king of the south, number 3, is an enemy both of the king of the north, corrupted religion, and God's true people, true religion, thus supporting an atheistic identity of the south. Revelation 13 shows the power of the papacy receiving a deadly wound at the close of the 1260-year reign in 1798. We'll study that when we get there. This, I believe, parallels the attack of Daniel 11, verse 40, when the south attacks the north at the time of the end. Revelation says the power of the medieval papacy, they're called the beast from the sea, would receive a mortal wound that would, at the end of the 3.5 times, that would then be healed for a time before Jesus comes. So I believe the deadly wound, the mortal wound of Revelation 13 is the same thing as at the time of the end, the south will attack the north and inflict what appears to be a deadly wound. Number 5, what brought down the medieval Roman papacy? Well, you know, we can say revolutionary France marched in and took the Pope captive. Well, that was the point, but that's just the tipping of the scale that had been underway for a long time. The Renaissance, letter A, promoted rationalism, education, and humanism, undermining the superstition of the papacy, which the papacy fostered to maintain control of the people. If you study your history carefully, you discover that during the medieval times, the people actually, for generations and generations, believed that their very soul was in the hand of the priest and the cardinals and the Pope. And it was with the rise of the Renaissance, the 13s, 14s, especially 14s, 15s, and 1600s, that people began to question this superstitious belief, and through scientific thought and rational thinking, they began to be freed up from thinking that their soul was in the hands of some other man. And it's really the power of the rationalistic era of the Renaissance that began to undermine the absolute control and power of the papacy. And if you look at the history, you discover that the papal power grew stronger and stronger up until about the 11 and 1200s, and then it begins to wane until, in 1798, it actually falls to the point where a political power comes and takes the Pope captive, and you have a transition of power again. Letter B, Revolutionary France, 1793 to 97, and I'm just now reading a book on the French Revolution, very interesting stuff, epitomized and institutionalized the atheistic, secular, humanistic movement. France came to the point where it outlawed all religion, true and false, and legislated rationalistic atheism. But it was simply the place and the point in time, the time and space where the whole thought of the rationalistic thinkers of the previous 150 years rooted down and bore fruit. By the way, the American experiment comes up about the same time, don't we? And you hear all these radio preachers who say we're a Christian nation, we are have a constitution founded on Christian principles, and we've got to get back to God and stop this separation of church and state and, you know, bring religion back into the government like it was supposed to be. Just study the lives and beliefs of the founding fathers. They got their ideas out of the French Revolution, not out of the Puritans. The Puritans who came over here wanted religious freedom for themselves. They never wanted to give it to anyone else. That's why Roger Williams got chased out to Rhode Island, where he had a little place where you could have religious freedom. The Puritans, which is our spiritual heritage here in North America, never wanted anyone to have religious freedom. It was the rationalists, like Jefferson and Franklin, who spent time over in France and soaked up the whole revolutionary fervor of the deistic beliefs of France, that wrote our Constitution and gave us the freedom of religion. Our freedom does not come from Christian people. It comes from deists, who are basically agnostics. God wound the place, built it, wound it up like a clock, and he's an impersonal God. Religious freedom in our nation is based on the concept of the natural rights of man, which is a phrase straight out of the French Revolution, not out of Puritanism. They never believed anybody had any rights except to do what they told them. This is one of the biggest propaganda messes we've got going in our world today. It's the Christian right trying to claim that the Christian roots of our Constitution should cause us now to go back and get rid of this evil thing called the separation of church and state and get God back in our government. All we'll have when we get God back in our government is a little papacy, because that's what the medieval papacy was all about, a government claiming to operate for God. By the way, I think that's prophetic, but we'll get there in time. Okay, I got on a side trip there, didn't I? France was the place where the concept of rationalistic religion took root and actually scared all the other governments of Europe. Because it brought down not only the state religion and the papal religion, but it brought down all the concept of monarchy. And all the other kings were afraid of this infection coming into their kingdoms as well. Letter C. France then delivered the pivotal blow at the end of the revolution in 1798, at the time of the end, taking the Pope captive and ending the civil political power of the papacy, tipping the balance of power away from the papacy and into the hands of the secular powers of Europe. Since that time, the secular humanistic movement, rooted in the Renaissance, has branched out into the various scientific, rational, atheistic, and materialistic thought groups present in our world today. To this day, the secular thought, at least in the Western world, has held the upper hand, the rationalistic secular thought that took the upper hand out of the French Revolution. America is part of that concept. That rationalistic thought spread to the rest of Europe, brought down pretty well the rest of the monarchies, or turned them into constitutional monarchs. Got rid of the religious power of the papacy, got rid of the monarchies for the most part. And to this day, we still have the rational secular ruling the roost over the religious. Which, by the way, is the only reason we have religious freedom, is because of unreligious people. Basically, or at least we have freedom of religion because of other than Christian thinkers. They usually want to take it away because they're convinced they're right and everybody ought to obey them. Number one, under letter D, science and the theory of evolution denies God in essence deifies nature. It's interesting, straight out of evolution and scientific thinking comes the New Age movement, back to where nature becomes God again, placing natural science above or in the place of God. Number two, politically, both communism and materialistic capitalism are direct results of the secular humanistic movement. There was no such thing as capitalism or communism or socialism until secular rationalism took the upper hand for medieval politicized religion. Therefore, I find that revolutionary France, and I believe we'll see this when we get to Revelation 11:8, is called spiritually Egypt. Revelation 11 talks about, I believe, the French Revolution. We'll get there and talk about it when we get there. And there that power is called spiritually Egypt. Notice, physically France, spiritually Egypt. The king of the south, when it goes past that point where the north becomes spiritual global and the church becomes spiritual global, would naturally also become spiritual global. So you have spiritual global apostasy, spiritual global anti-God, atheism, humanism, and caught in between is spiritual global Israel, God's church, and truth. Atheism and humanism hate both true religion and apostate religion. And apostate religion certainly hates the humanist, both true religion and secular humanistic rationalism. King of the South, I believe, is anti-religion, atheism, and secular humanism as rooted in the Renaissance, exemplified by revolutionary France, and rules in Western society to this day. So what is the Glorious Land? The Glorious Land is clearly pointed out in the earlier part of chapter 11 and other places, I believe, as Palestine, Israel, the home of God's people, the line of faith. Before AD 34, it would be Palestine, the home of the chosen and faithful people who were to live and shine as beacons to the world of truth, Israel. After AD 34, the end of the 70 weeks of Daniel 9, God's faithful people are the glorious land wherever they are found shining forth in the world. Again, becomes global spiritually. All right. Have you followed that so far? I know we've done a whole lot of stuff. But you have the North, which represents apostate religion rooted clear back to Babylon. Sure, we believe in God, but let's build a tower and save ourselves. Let's do it our own way, do-it-yourself religion. You have the South, which is epitomized clear back in Egypt, that said, never heard of the guy, never heard of God. Who is he? And you have the Glorious Land, God's people, caught in between. The North hates the South hates the North, and they both hate God's people. So, what will happen during the time of the end? Let's now look at chapter 11, verse 40 again. At the time of the end. When's that, according to what we said so far? At 1798, we should be able to see an attack of the king of the south upon the king of the north, him. And I believe we see that at the end of the 1260 years, the 3.5 times, revolutionary France, the legacy, spiritual legacy from Egypt, atheistic rationalism, never heard of God, don't want anything to do with him, attacks the apostate religious system, the medieval papacy, and brings it down. Then it says, oh, by the way, and that's where we live. We live right on that semicolon at the end of the first phrase of verse 40. At the time of the end, 1798, the king of the south, secular humanism, will attack and bring down him, the king of the north. Boom, there we are. The deadly wound of Revelation 13 has been inflicted. Now, it says, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, many ships. He will enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So we see that the next thing that's going to happen in this sequence is that the north, apostate religion, which was brought down in 1798, will attack with everything it has, the secular humanistic south. Apostate religion will reunite, I believe, with political power, reforming something an awful lot like the medieval papacy, seeking to regain the spiritual and political control it once had. This is yet future, or present and future. It will be an all-out attack. Notice he comes with chariots and horsemen and many ships, enters the countries. Much bigger than, but will likely include a revived and invigorated old world papacy. And Revelation 13 will put the scenario together. Overwhelms and passes through, letter C. We saw that in verse 10, which was a reference to God's people in the middle, like the tide rising from the north and overflowing into the south and receding, and then the tide rising from the south, overflowing into the north, and God's people are flooded every time. So, overwhelm and pass through. Pass through to the other side and overwhelm on the way God's people. God's faithful people are caught in the middle again between the north and the south, apostate religion and secular humanism and their battle. True religion is hated by both apostasy and atheism. Letter D. Verse 41, he shall enter the glorious land. Glorious land, and many shall be overthrown. A direct attack on God's faithful people by the revived north with persecution reminiscent of the Middle Ages. And when we get to Revelation, what we discover is that the Middle Ages is a macrocosm of exactly what will happen after the healing of that deadly wound, after the North takes power again, in a very short microcosm in the time of the end. What happened before will happen again, with a little respite in between. But what happens again at the end is many times hotter and very much shorter. Like you take 100 cubic feet of air and compress it into one, and what happens? It gets very hot. There's not very much of it. It doesn't last very long, but it's very hot. The same principle. This great time of trouble Jesus talked about, the prophecies break into two pieces with a little time of respite in the middle. I think we live in that respite. The king of the south attacked the north. That brought the respite to pass. The king of the north will fight back. That will bring it to an end. A short, hot period of time, much like the medieval time. And Jesus comes and brings it to an end. So he will enter the glorious land. Verse 41. And many countries will be overthrown. Page 4 of the notes. Verse 41. But these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now, who are these people? Once again, if we're dealing with the time of the end, should we take Edom, Moab, and Ammon, which were little countries right over here on this side of the Dead Sea? Right over here was Ammon and Moab, and Edom was down here to the south. Okay, so you have three countries, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, right here around to the east and south of Jerusalem and Israel. Physically. Now, if we're in the time of the end and talking about Edom, Moab, and Ammon, would we be talking literal countries over there, or would we also move to global spiritual concepts based on the original? I'd move to global spiritual. What would these be? Well, who were Edom, Moab, and Ammon? These nations no longer exist, I think, leading further evidence that this passage must be taken symbolic and not literal. Number two, these nations were related to Israel. The descendants of Abraham. Edom descended from Esau, who's the brother of Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, Jacob and Esau. And Moab and Ammon were sons of Lot. Lot was Abraham's nephew. Remember how they were born? It's one of the more juicy stories of the Bible. When Lot left Sodom, what happened to his wife? She became a pillar of salt. Lot took his two daughters up in the mountains and they lived in a cave. See, you have cavemen right there in the Bible. And they got him drunk. They said, we're going to be disgraced if we never have children. There aren't any other men in this cave, so what are we going to do? So they got their father drunk, and one of them went in and lay with their father, and she got pregnant. The next night they got him drunk again, and the other one went in and she got pregnant, and out came Moab and Ammon. That's where they came from. Interesting stories in the Bible. I'm surprised that some folks haven't thought we should censor them. I don't know. Yeah, that's true. They may not have known that, but God burned everything up. Yeah. I suppose if you thought you were the only three people left on earth, you'd rationalize some of that a lot easier. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, number three. These nations were enemies of God's people, though they were relatives, who in the last days will come to obey Israel, God's faithful people, according to a prophecy of Isaiah 11:11-14. You can go home and read that. Talks about in the last days Edom, Moab, and Ammon coming to be in sync with God's people, Israel. You can also see some more in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And what I'm going to say about this is I'm not sure how to apply this. So this is another little I don't know piece. Not sure how that applies. But let's move on. Verse 42, he will stretch out his hand. Now this is the king of the north who's fighting back. He will stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. The south, or secular humanism, in the time of the end will fall before the resurging power of politicized religion. Letter G. Verse 43, but he will have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Now, during the medieval time, the money and the power was in the hands of the church. Since the time of the end began, 1798 and on, the money and power have been in the hands of the secular humanists, the governments, the secular governments. This tells me the money and power is going to go back to the politicized religion, which has something to do with the papacy, revived, I believe, but is much bigger and more global yet. Verse 43, last phrase, also the Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. This again is tough. These would have to be a spiritual application of those countries. The only thing I've heard that makes sense is these countries were some of the most remote in the time of Daniel. This therefore could refer to the reassertion of the power of politicized religion, that it will go global, reaching to the remotest places of the earth, as supported by the book of Revelation. But I'm not too sure how we pull the Ethiopians and the Libyans in here. Again, is it talking about Gaddafi? I don't think so, because we've moved from literal, physical to spiritual, global principles, okay? I think once we get on a horse, we got to ride it all the way through instead of switching horses all the time. If you get on the literal, stay on the literal. If you get on the symbolic, stay on the symbolic. So I'm not going to go riding through on the symbolic and then say, whoops, but that's Gaddafi. See, Libya or whatever. Yes. Could deal with spiritualism. Again, I think... Yep. I think we'll understand when it happens. And for now, we're kind of wasting our time trying to figure out... I'm not saying your comments are relevant, but to try and get too specific, we can speculate, but we better hold it pretty much as speculation. Verse 44, but news from the east and the north will trouble him, the king of the north. Therefore, he will go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. News from the east and the north will trouble him. I believe that refers to when Jesus says there will be a final spreading of the gospel to the world. Why do I get that? Well, east seems to be the direction of God's comings and goings. The entrance to the tabernacle was from the east. And in Ezekiel, when God left the tabernacle, he went to the east. And when he came back into the rebuilt temple of Ezekiel, he came from the east. East seems to be when God steps in. North is apostasy, south is denial, and east is God's direction. Cyrus, interestingly enough, and this has to play in here, was the power that came from the north and the east to deliver Israel from Babylon. And Cyrus is likened to a type of Christ in the prophecies about him. He would be a deliverer like the Messiah, one anointed of God who would come and deliver God's people from Babylon. And he comes from the north and the east. Notice, he comes from over here off to the far right-hand side. He comes from the east, which is really to Israel, the north. He comes from the north and the east. But east seems to be when God steps in. But it's interesting that news from the north and the east, and Cyrus comes from the north of the east, this seems to deal with God stepping in. News from the north and the east, I believe, is a message that goes out in the end time, according to the book of Revelation, of the soon coming of Jesus. This gospel will be preached in all the world. And then the end will come. Well, what would trouble apostate religion is it's about to get the upper hand again. It's more than this tremendous proclamation that Jesus is coming. One thing apostate religion doesn't want is the return of Jesus, nor the spread of the true gospel. That's its greatest enemy. Of course, who's behind apostate religion? Satan. Who doesn't want Jesus to come and take over? Satan. What did Satan say? I will become like the Most High. I will sit on the furthest sides of the north. It seems to be the mythological meeting place of the gods. So north and east seems to tie together the concept of the gods or God stepping in, and the east is the true God. Just kind of got to let this pull together a little bit. If you look too close, it doesn't make sense. If you back up, you begin to see kind of a picture. Judgment comes from the north. You're right. Therefore, because of this proclamation or this news from the east, I believe the final great giving of the gospel, Revelation 18, an angel comes down and the glory of that angel enlightens the whole world, the final giving of the gospel message, therefore he'll go out to destroy and annihilate many. Jesus said there will be a final great time of persecution. The book of Revelation says after this deadly wound is healed, all the atrocities of the medieval times will happen again in the time of the end. There will be a great time of destruction and persecution, just as there was before. Verse 45. And he will plant the tents of his palace, or his war tents as it were, between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Tent, or the camp of his palace, would seem to be the field headquarters of the attacking army of the north. Between, or separating, the seas. Seas in Revelation 17:15, we've already seen, represents the people and the nations. And the glorious holy mountain appears to represent God's glorious truth and people, the glorious land. Apostate religion will attempt to come down and get in between the truth and the multitudes. That's what it wants to do, is keep the multitudes from getting to the glorious land. To keep the people from hearing the truth about God and following it. He will attempt to separate, a final attempt to keep truth away from the masses and thus solidify total control by corrupting the truth and annihilating God's people of truth, just as they did in the Middle Ages. But, last phrase, he will come to his end and no one will help him. That seems to suggest that God steps in and brings down the King of the North. The King of the North will bring down the King of the South. God will bring down the King of the North. The stone cut out without hands. He comes to his end mysteriously. Boom, he's gone, and there's no one that can help. Why? Because God's power is overwhelming. The court in chapter 7 would take away his dominion and consume and destroy it forever. Verse chapter 8, he will be broken without human hand. Daniel 9, until the consummation which is determined, God is going to bring it to an end. So you have all of these pictures of the end of time, not the time of the end, but the end of time, when things come to a close. Not because human beings do anything, but God steps in. He comes to his end, and there's no one that can help, because, chapter 12, verse 1, Michael stands up. God steps up to the plate. And when he swings the bat, it's a home run every time. Revelation 10 to 18, I believe, supports and expands on this interpretation of Daniel 11. And to me, that's why I think it's important, because what Daniel does is expanded and supported in the book of Revelation. And often we as a church have gone places with Daniel 11, 40 to 45, that do not follow the track of Revelation. And yet Revelation seems to be dealing with this very period of time. So I believe whatever we do with this section, this is the microcosm of which, upon which Revelation expands. Revelation predicts, letter A, that following the infliction of a mortal wound on the medieval papacy, chapter 13, verse 3, at the close of the 1260 years, 1798, the 3.5 times, this wound will then be healed. There will be a brief period of astonishing A brief and astonishingly successful revival of a religious political entity, much like but greater than the medieval papacy, when the whole world marveled and followed after its power. We live after the attack of the King of the South, verse 40, which inflicted the deadly wound of 1798. We live during the counterattack. All around us, Christians of all persuasions are reaching to the power of politics in an all-out attack against the evils of secular humanism, thus seeking to reestablish religious control through civil authority. This religio-political mix is what created the medieval papacy and will recreate a similar type establishment on a global level in the future. This harbinger of the future should be clear to see now, with its strength and power increasing daily. The remainder of verses 40 to 45 after that first verse is yet future, I believe. The final end will then come by divine intervention. Okay? That's what we do with that. We can't be too specific. You'll notice I didn't go around naming names. Some folks do. That's fine for them. But there is going to be, or there was, an attack by secularism on politicized religion, medieval style, that brought it down. But that power is being healed and is growing again, whether you look at the papacy or whether you look at the Christian right in America. It is growing in power, and it will attack and succeed in taking down secular humanism, reestablishing yet future something very much like but bigger and hotter than the medieval, which does all the things just like but bigger and hotter that the medieval did. And during that terrible time, There will be a final, ultimate proclamation of the gospel, and Jesus will come and bring it to an end. And that simple scenario is what the entire book of Revelation just about deals with. So this is the piece of Daniel that springboards us in to Revelation. I hope that was clear, or reasonably so. And let's have a prayer. Lord, help us to understand these things. Help us to mull them over in our minds. Help us to read these passages until they're in our minds and we can just think about them so your Spirit can work in our minds on these things. Lord, help us not to become caught up in the trivia of trying to predict the future or sensationalism. Help us not to lose the bigger picture by trying to get things down to too fine of detail now. But help us to simply accept and realize that there's stuff ahead, which is patterned after what has gone before, that's going to be pretty rough. But in the midst of that, you will call your people to spread the gospel to the world. And we have always been able to see in history that it's the times of peace when the light grows dim. It's in the times of trouble when your church shines the brightest. Lord, as we move into those times, may we be following you day by day so that when trouble comes, we'll simply just keep following you, knowing that even if we lose our lives, you are the resurrection and...